All right. Our next speaker is going to talk about the ballpark sports game, outfield advertising, and the branding issue. Now, our next speaker is got a little baseball bloodline in him. If you look on the screen, bottom right, our speaker here is the, what is this, the son.
The son.
The son okay. of 1945 Detroit Tiger MVP, Eddie Mayo. So, got a celebrity in the building. Currently teaches at Notre Dame. Go Irish, right? And I'm not going to say any more. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Mayo.
I'm going to assume that this photograph up here and the question above it, which was posed by Frank DeFord, is relevant to anybody that claims to be a baseball fan. As you look at it and say, how many buildings in your life do you really become attached to? Baseball fans, including all of us, get attached emotionally to baseball teams and oftentimes to the places that they call home. And that's what we're going to be looking at here today. The answer to my question was Tiger Stadium, because I got, or Brick Stadium as it was in my youth, was a place that I got to go to work with my dad all the time, and I got really, really emotionally attached to that particular building. What is a ballpark? That's really, in essence, the question we have to ask here this morning. What is a ballpark? And there's a lot of different answers to that particular question. We've been looking at the whole issue of outdoor advertising or ballpark advertising for the last year or so, and making a couple of different presentations about it. And one of the things that has come to, you know, clear out loud and clear in that whole process is that when you look at ballpark advertising, clutter is what describes the scene, and it's always been that case from the very beginning. The top picture in this particular case is Fenway Park in 1914. There was 18 or 19 commercial messages on what came to be known as the Green Monster many years later, and then it was clear for some 50 years. And now we have Progressive Field, which has this, what I call, so-called scoreboard, which is really just an advertising platform. You know, try to find some of the information, baseball information on that, amongst that clutter of advertising is a real challenge for most people. So what we're talking about here today is ballpark advertising and the fan experience from an interior designer's standpoint. And I need you to ask, this is the question, does advertising clutter impact the fan experience and the team brand? And I need you to think about it from this standpoint. You talk about advertising clutter in a ballpark, and people say, well, you don't have to pay attention to it. You don't have to pay attention to it. But look at it from an entire gestalt standpoint. I've got to go back here for a second. From a gestalt standpoint, all of the sensory information that we're being bombarded with in a ballpark environment. Start with noise. Does anybody in here admit to loving walk-up music? Or Harry Belafonte yelling out "Deo," constantly. Or the 19-year-old public address announcer who's trying to entertain us between innings. So excessive noise in a ballpark is an obvious one that it's really hard to get away from. But if you create the gestalt, it's the noise, it's the visual overstimulation, if you will. It's other senses. It's the it's the flat beer and the lousy hot dog. It's the 18-inch seat that you're put into. The long lines at restrooms and concession stands and so forth. Parking, that's a real challenge and so forth. So all of our senses get bombarded in one way or another. And what we're looking at here specifically today is to look at outfield advertising foul pole to foul pole, and trying to examine how that impacts the fan experience for all of us. Research methodology, very quickly. We put together a review panel 6 interior designers, an ad agency executive who had 25 years of experience, 25 years of brand management experience, an ad agency graphic artist, a couple of sports marketing consultants. And we picked 8 ballparks, couldn't take all 30, but took 8 that seemed to represent a range from too much advertising clutter in the ballpark to something that's relatively clear. And we asked this panel of people to independently evaluate those 8 ballparks and to independently rank them from best to worst, or worst to best, as the case may be. Now, this may be the most important slide in this entire presentation here. I want you to look at these 2 pictures here. This is before and after. And remember, what we already defined a ballpark is, one way to define it, is that it's a second home. So from that standpoint, let's take some of the principles of interior design and apply it to the ballpark as a second home. These 2 pictures here, before and after, the interior designers tell us that that top picture has no focus. There's no unity to it. I mean, there's too many different dominant colors. There's several different focal points. And if you look over in the corner, it's really well hidden. And that's a TV set that nobody obviously could read, you know, watch in that particular living room. The second is the after. After some interior designer got a hold of that room and reconstructed, if you will, for following these principles that we see on the left-hand side. We've asterisked the focal point, the scale and proportion and color as really relevant to the ballparks that we're looking at here this morning. Now, this, I'm sure nobody in the back can read this, but I'm allowed to have 2 slides in every presentation that I have to read to you, because it's just critical information. Here's the conclusions that we're going to reach. 7 different rules. The most important rule, the game is not the core product. The fan experience is. It's the game that delivers that fan experience. The fan is there primarily for 2 things, to relax and to socialize. The Wrigley rule, 2, the outfield fence is part of the playing field. It should not contain, in an ideal world, it should not contain any advertising signage. And it's at some point that the accountant in the back is going to say, Mayo's nuts, you know, but I'll stay here and listen to the rest of this. The Fenway Park rule, if the outfield fence advertising is absolutely positively required, it should follow a common color standard. And this is also known as the Dodger rule. 4, the progressive rule. The modern scoreboard should not be an advertising platform where sponsors get to play, made you look, made you look. 5, the city rule. Sponsors should not be allowed to use the ballpark for an advertising arms race where bigger, brighter, flashier is better. 6, the PBS rule. Really key here. The best ballpark advertising is not advertising. And 7, Al the accountant rule. And Al's up in the top right-hand corner here. Don't let Al control the ballpark's look and feel. Put someone else in charge of the team and stadium brand. Just don't let it be Al. Okay, so let's take some looks here. First one we'll look at is, we're not going to look at all 8, but you know, a handful of these 8 stadiums. Globe Life Park in Arlington. How many people have ever been there? A lot of people. Okay, familiar with some of that scenery. Now, the 4-story office building in center field was intended to create, according to the architects, an urban feel to the ballpark. But from a signage standpoint, there was 3 main problems. The oversized signage on top of the office building, which is, as you know, an office building. Team offices in there and other offices rented out to others. The oversized signage atop that office building, our interior design panel says, negates its intended effect and creates a concrete donut, a 3 rivers veteran stadium type of feel to it. The outfield signage is cluttered and along the bottom, the fence itself, cluttered in a blur of colors. Some signage fails to pass the squint test, and are we seeing this on the bottom? It's not here. It's if you look at it from the standpoint of focal points, In an interior designer's world, any particular room should have one focal point in a very large room, a ballpark, two, maybe three focal points. If you start counting up the focal points in Arlington, you've got the office building, you've got the signage on top of it, you have the baseball field, which should always be a focal point in a ballpark, but you also have the home run, porch in right field, and the scoreboard on top of it. So at least five focal points in this ballpark. Let's go to Pittsburgh. Beautiful cityscape that you can look out on. What do the interior designers say about Pittsburgh, PNC Park? The main focal point in the signage is obviously the cityscape. And the main focal point is there, and the signage does not really interfere with that at all. Overall, the architect's use of color throughout the ballpark, interior and exterior, the interior design panel says it was excellent. The use of several different colors on the outfield advertising signage does not create a unified look and feel, although the modest amount of advertising in PNC Park sort of minimizes the damage there. And without, you know, before leaving this particular slide, when the interior designers looked at that ketchup bottle, they, to a person, winced. And they end up asking the question, what would have been lost had Heinz just said, put our name on there? We don't have to have a ketchup bottle oozing ketchup out onto the fence. So, we've got our standings. We've looked at two, PNC and Arlington. Wonder where they show up on our standings. PNC comes in third, and Globe Life Park in Arlington is now in sixth place. Now, before we go on, let's ask some questions. Again, our main theme here is, how does advertising clutter impact the fan experience? Look at this graph closely, and it describes the relationship between team, sponsors, and fans. Team rents out space, gets money from sponsors, and they give them sign space on top of the roof or, you know, on the fence. The team gives the fans a baseball experience, and in return, they get money from fans. The relationship between fans and sponsors. Well, the fans are supposed to lend their eyeballs to the sponsor looking at their signage. And the sponsors, in return, give the fan nothing. It doesn't add anything to the experience. There's a question mark there. So over time, what happens is that fans do their best to ignore that advertising. They're not getting anything in return. Ignore it to the extent that you can. Block it out. Let's ask a few other questions. The batter's eye. These are rhetorical questions. The batter's eye. Why is it uncluttered and dark green and black or black? Isn't it to give the batter a better chance of seeing a 96 mile an hour heater coming in and have giving him a chance to actually make contact with that ball? Why aren't fans given, you know, the same advantage without the distractions to be able to focus on the game on the field? These answers down below were fake answers, by the way. It was a trick question. Next question, Wrigley Field. Why do people love ivy-covered outfield walls? Isn't it part of the Cubs brand statement? And let's go to Boston. The Green Monster, is there a more dominant focal point in any major league park? The Green Monster, why is it considered the core of the Red Sox brand equity? And that's not Ed Mayo speaking. That's the Harvard Business School that have studied this thing and said it's the Green Monster that's a, you know, central part of the Red Sox brand. The Green Monster is the number one tourist attraction in the state of Massachusetts. When they run tours for kids, they allow them on the field. The first thing kids do is they run out and they touch the wall. You know, I mean, that's the significance of that. But in fact, Fenway Park is really two different parks from a signage standpoint. We have the Green Monster Fenway. The focal point is the Green Monster itself. Advertising is limited to not much more than a sponsor name and logo. It's white on green, which emulates the foul lines, the bases, and the uniforms of the home team, if you think about that. Advertising is not advertising. It's more like the PBS announcement that says, this program is brought to you by General Electric and other contributors to PBS and people like you. You know, so it's not advertising. And the Monster is seen as uncluttered and non-commercial, and if you go over to right field, this is what you see. Something that duplicates what you find in other major league ballparks. There's a notable contrast with the Green Monster. There's no color scheme to it. Fortunately, it's spread out enough that it minimizes the damage, but if you look along the bullpen fence, if you will, you see it wasn't too many years ago, there was nothing on that fence. And now it's creeping across, and now it's on the center field wall, and it's got its sights on the Green Monster and says, we're going to get over there. So that's, you know, the other part of the Fenway Park story. So here's the, you know, we're not going to go through all of these stadiums, but here's the final standings of the panel. Dodger Stadium in first place, followed by Fenway, PNC Park, and we got Yankee Stadium and Citi Field down the bottom, and we better explain those. How are we doing on time here? Okay. First of all, this is easily dismissed. People have been at Citi Field. Okay, see if you agree with this or not. The question is, what does all of that signage, I mean, it's everywhere. It's 150 feet in the air. It's everywhere. It's in the bullpens, out of the bullpens. It's up on the light standards. It's on the fences. It's everywhere. The question is, what does all of that signage say about the New York Mets brand? And I'll leave that as a rhetorical question for you. Let's go to Yankee Stadium. We can look at this and say, my question is, what is the focal point in the new Yankee Stadium? To me, it's, you know, it's the video board and all of the signage that extends out from, in either direction from it. And you notice that the Yankees also could not resist the urge to keep a lot of signage on the outfield fence itself. Okay? Now I'll take you back to my youth. I went to a lot of games at Yankee Stadium when my dad was playing with the Tigers, and you know, we lived in New Jersey and went over to see him play there often. And even after he left the Tigers, we were there because we lived in Jersey and so forth. There were three things that stood out to me as a youth when I went to Yankee Stadium. One I didn't understand was a big no betting sign right next to the scoreboard. Until I learned about the Black Sox scandal, I didn't really understand what that was about. But the other two things that really stood out to me was the monuments in center field. They were in play, albeit relatively small from 300 feet away. They were still visible, probably in large part because the people playing in front of them were focal points themselves. First Joe DiMaggio and then Mickey Mantle. So you were looking at these guys all of the time and the monuments were there. Now if you look at what has taken place in the new Yankee Stadium, the heritage that the Yankees have, and they try to, you know, leverage and make the most of, in the new Yankee Stadium they created, what do they call it, Monument Gardens, I believe it is? Park, Monument Park. You can take a tour of that. But if you're in the stand, you cannot see it unless you're in the top 15 rows of the third deck. So here's a heritage that they're saying, well, yeah, but we got a lot of advertising money coming in here. And if we were to do something like what they did in St. Louis or Chicago, trying to celebrate the heritage in one way or another, the Yankees have more than enough heritage to put up on those walls again. If you look back at it, and say instead of being AT&T or Ford up there, what if it was Babe Ruth or Lou Gehrig or any number of other former Yankee greats that were up there in some creative way? Now, Dodger Stadium is the last of our looks here because they came in first place. What have they done right? First of all, Walter O'Malley's vision was a stadium with no advertising except for a Union oil sign that was on top of the scoreboard at one point in time. That's all there was in the very beginning. But Al the accountant says you got to get some advertising revenue coming in here. They've done it right. They've done most of it right. The scoreboards are not used, by and large, as advertising platforms. They don't interfere with the incredible view that you get there on a clear day. Excellent use of color on the outfield fences. Standard white on blue on blue. And there's a standardized size of the sign so that one advertiser, one sponsor, is not yelling out, "Look at me, look at me, look at me." It's all sort of PBS oriented. We're here, we're supporting the team, and we're not trying to outshout the next guy. So this is, you know, some of the reasons. There's one thing, if you look closely at the middle photograph here, above the Bud Light sign and the Universal Studio sign to the right, they've made the mistake of, you know, there's a gap between the fence and where the grandstand starts, maybe 10 or 12 feet. And on the railing and back of that, what they've done is put a MasterCard sign and, I don't know, a Sharper image or somebody on the other part of that. You know, the interior designers don't like that. You know, they went over a little bit overboard on that. So, again, the standings are Dodger Stadium down to Citi Field and everybody in between. Our question that we've been trying to address here, does advertising impact the fan experience and the team brand? I'd probably pose more questions here than answers. And just as the last slide here, let's go back and review this. Al, the accountant, the most important rule is the game is not the core product. It's the fan experience that is. The Wrigley rule, the outfield fence is part of the playing field. In an ideal world, it should not have advertising on it. Fenway rule, if outfield fence advertising is absolutely positively required, it should follow a common color standard. The progressive rule, the scoreboard should not be an advertising platform. The city rule, sponsors should not be allowed to use the ballpark for an advertising arms race. The PBS rule is the best ballpark advertising is not advertising. And lastly, get Al out of the way. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I happen to be the director. I happen at the time to be the director of marketing of Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh. And when we were approached for advertising, not just for the baseball park, but for the hockey arena as well, there was no mention of any subtle rules or regulations. The only mention was that we needed to do it in order to support the team. And we were given financial figures to show that the advertising revenue, including the naming rights, which we did not accept, the advertising revenue was crucial to the building of the stadium. So I challenged the PBS rule of no advertising. No advertising, no stadium. All right.
I don't know what to say in response to that, you know.
This is just a comment, but I find disturbing the kinetic advertising that is everywhere now. And those green things around the infield, I cannot tolerate that sensory overload. All that stuff moving and flashing and LEDs. And I don't know what else to say.
Did you get an idea at all about what some of the investment is on these packages and what they may consist of beyond just signage? You know, is every single one of these part of some kind of sponsor deal that comes with tickets and other things? I'm curious.
Well, you know, here's an answer to your question too, and I appreciate you bringing up the Pittsburgh thing. There's outfield signage, which this should clearly make it clear that there's the likelihood that too much advertising out in the field of vision is interfering with the fan experience. There are other ways for sponsors to get their message to this captive audience. I mean, you go to Detroit and Comerica, and there's a couple other ballparks like this. The GM has a couple of mounted trucks or cars that are out in the field of vision. Did they really need, what would have been lost if they took those cars down and put them on the concourse or the entranceway coming in where people can actually get close to the car, maybe talk to somebody that represents GM there? There are other options for the advertisers other than trying to do what you were saying over here, is the ribbon advertising that's moving and flashing along and really distracting you. Rather than just taking the PBS approach and saying, we're proud supporters of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and leave it go at that. What is lost by not being able to say, because it really is outdoor roadside advertising, if they're going to watch you, they're only going to see you for 2 seconds. So there's not much you can say other than say, hey, we're here, or by implication, we're the proud supporters of the Pirates.
I know you're talking about ballpark, but there are some. I grew up in Philly, and it was a big deal to have the Ferrero Cadillac sign on top of Contract Stadium left field, because that's where Dick Allen would hit his home runs. And at Ebbets Field, the name Star Kid hit it here again, getting a free custard soup. And I'm not mistaken, Ebbets Field, I think, had advertising all over it.
Oh, yeah.
And I just wonder. And I'm going to look at the current stuff, have you looked at the other stuff? Because those are iconic signages, and I just wonder if you thought of that as well, the old days as well.
We've looked back over the course of the last century. We did a presentation in Cooperstown last month that looked at it over a 100-year period. And yeah, Abe hit the suit, win a suit sign. As I recall, nobody ever won a suit for one reason or another. But it was iconic. But for every one of those, there's 500 other signs that are not iconic that maybe don't belong there. At least to the extent that they're interfering with the fan experience as such.
All right, last question. What are your thoughts on ballpark modifications that could impact advertising? I'm thinking particular Wrigley.
Ballpark modifications that, and you're thinking specifically Oakland, is that what you said?
Wrigley.
I'll give you one example from Comerica that'll answer that question, because my dad played on that 45 series against the Cubs, so Wrigley and Detroit are tied together here. In 1999, when they were closing down the old Tiger Brick Stadium complex, they had a great weekend for all the old Tigers to come back, and they did all the memorabilia stuff and so forth. And I was a special guest of my dad at that particular function. And then that final game, that Sunday afternoon, we were sitting in behind home plate, all the players are back there. And my dad is 89 years old at the time. And he gets up in the third inning to go down to the restroom. And he comes back and he says, it's time. I said, what do you mean? He says, it's time to take this place down. The restrooms were, from a different age. It was time, From a standpoint, in Wrigley, if you look at the Wrigley, the Cubs trademark proposition as a brand, it's that, what happens if you take away the ivy-covered walls? What if you put the big Toyota ad up in left field? What does that do? How do you measure the value of the brand for Wrigley as it stands now? That's regardless of, the discomforts in the restrooms and so forth and so on. But from an advertising standpoint, I personally would think it would be a mistake, to give in to Al the account on that one.
Okay. Anybody has any other questions for Ed?
Sure.
Thank you very much.